Speaking about my trauma can trigger me. In extreme cases, I can feel really re-traumatized afterwards. None of this is easy, and none of it is very nice, especially when it happens. But the speaking on a stage is what is giving my life some meaning. And I want to give meaning to all my life lessons. One thing has become clear to me recently. I am not my scars. I'm not my wounds. I'm not the product of my bullying. I'm not a product of my past. I don't look or focus on these acts. I am a product of my healing. I am those quiet moments alone where I gently hold myself and love myself while I cry tears, sometimes of joy. I am the hugs of encouragement from my friends. I'm the therapeutic sunrise moment I witness as a gift. I'm the restorative morning run when I try to get my health better. I'm the smile on my psychologist's face when she sees progress. I'm the supportive comment on Facebook from an old friend knocking down a cyberbully of mine. I'm standing here not as a compilation, a mixed bag product of my traumas, but rather as a miracle of my healing. A mosaic of the magical and beautiful little things that happen while I put myself back together. I am a hero of my healing. I'm not the millions of moments of doubt. I am that one moment of, phew, I can do this. These little things that put me back together and rebuilt me slowly make me who I am today, not the things that broke me. It's these restorative forces that help me. I'm not a result of rape. I am a result of healing from rape. I'm all the moments of inspiration that have put me back together. I am the responsibility I have taken to heal. I'm not owning my trauma. I'm also not going back to relive it all. I'm not re-traumatizing myself to make a point to rework it all, to remix it all and be a byproduct of my PTSD again. I'm not taking myself back to suicidal ideation where I'm selecting the knife to cut my own wrists. I am, however, owning every healing moment since I put the knives away. I'm collecting every building block of love I have noticed, been handed, or even found lying around. I stand before you as a beacon of my healing, a master of my own circumstances, not a victim of my troubles. I am a collection of miracles from this body of perfection, a miracle of this hot, messy, delicious moment. I'm the hero of my healing process. But you say, Costa, I'm broken and full of pain. I can't go on. Sitting there with one friend's arm over your shoulder, just that one friend, just that one half moon you admire, the one feather you find lying on the floor, that one song that makes you feel like a little bit more like you, the one piece of good news, the one person who makes a smile at you, the one green robot that feels like it's waiting just for your car to cross in crazy traffic before changing, that one second, minute, or hour of connection to yourself. You are a product of these moments. Moments to remind you of who you are and why you're here. Cry, and cry, and cry some more, and keep crying. But don't you notice that often you end off a cry with a messy laugh, like, oh shit, look at me, I'm a hot mess, and you let out a giggle. Or, look at my ridiculous puffy face. Yes, you ended that with a laugh too. You're only laughing because you have cried. Grab that precious moment instantly. Hold it tight. Put it in your bag of healing moments. Put that one drop of fuel in the tank of your day. Pick yourself up and remind yourself, you are those moments. You are not your trauma. You are your healing.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. Here we get to chat to some of the world's most interesting and influential people about everything to do with physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. If you want to make healthy changes and live a better life, you are in the right place. Please don't forget to rate, leave a review, and share with everyone who wants to live their best life. And now your host, Nikki Robertson.
There's so many themes in there that ring true. And, you know, yes, we're all taught to, you know, you've got to deal with the trauma, but you're not your trauma. You're a human being who can heal. And I think that is possibly the most important part of your message. So, Costa, thank you so much for joining me on the Reinvent Health podcast today.
Hi, Nikki.
So let's start with your story. I've read most of your book. I'm about halfway through. I'm reading a lot of books at the moment, and I'm absolutely loving every part of it. It's touching me spiritually, emotionally, mentally on so many levels because I can relate. And I think a lot of people, when they buy the book and they read it, will also on some level relate because on some level we've all been through this stuff. So let's get it firsthand from you. Let's do an abridged version because I want people to buy your book. So we don't want to give it all away. But let's go through right to the beginning from when you were this little Greek boy at school who suddenly felt alien.
So this is exciting to be here. I really appreciate this opportunity, Nikki. So my book is a certain arc of my life, a part of my life and an arc of my life that caused a lot of pain. Starting off with childhood bullying, childhood depression. It's a tale of othering. Somebody gave me that word once. When you other than, you're the odd one out. And to a degree, every single person on this planet has felt that. Mine was more acute. Mine was something I couldn't handle. Mine was something I needed to soothe. That's the word, soothe. And soothing took the form of many things. But the successful soothing mechanism I found as a young boy was alcohol. Smoking.
How thereafter. Old were you when you found alcohol and smoking?
I got passed out drunk when I was 12.
Wow. Okay. Take us through that. Was it at a party? Was it parents' alcohol? Were you
sleeping? Yes, something? It was my friend. I grew up in a home where there was always alcohol.
Okay.
My parents don't drink. They might have a half a beer or half a whiskey to about five times a year at the most. Okay. And I was never told alcohol was wrong. It's not something I wanted to always do because it was naughty. No, I just, you know, I was at this party, my friend Alan's bar mitzvah. Somebody poured a glass of sparkling wine. So we toasted.
Yes.
And I said, cheers. And I toasted. And I had the glass of sparkling champagne. And at the end of the first glass, I started just feeling numb. And I really enjoyed that feeling.
Yeah.
So I had the whole bottle.
Oh.
because and the way I see it now is, and I go because later in life, a series of traumas and events from abusive relationship, codependent relationship issues, to hijacking and the kidnapping situation at gunpoint, and a whole lot of unresolved traumas. One of the biggest ones being that sexuality and identity, grappling with that. I needed somewhere or something to use, help me hide, or just help soothe the pain. And I found alcohol and it did that. But then again, it stopped doing that.
Yeah.
I needed something stronger. And I was a very high-functioning alcoholic. I could go weeks without drinking, but then I was a binge drinker. And, you know, we live in a country where you can very easily be a binge drinker and it won't even get noticed. Yeah. And, in fact, it didn't really go noticed. And I was very high-functioning, worked hard, did well at university, started my own businesses, really enjoyed life. Work became a kind of addiction. And addiction then became the theme of my life where I was looking for things outside of me to soothe the pain inside of me.
All right.
And I found alcohol. I found cigarettes. Mm-hmm. I found love. And I found other things like destructive love, hooked on that feeling, that dopamine rush of pain, because, you know, pain and pleasure are very, very intimately linked.
Absolutely.
And then I dabbled a little bit with weed when I was in my early 30s. And then alcohol just stopped working. It stopped working. I ended an abusive relationship. And that same weekend, I started hard drugs for the first time. Yeah. So I put down the love drug and I picked up the hard drug. Uh-huh. And what I learned about my drug use is I didn't really enjoy using in public. I always felt dirty. I knew it was wrong. My friends were not using addicts. I always had to hide it, and it was complicated. What I wanted to do was switch myself off. I wanted to go to a place of zero, a place of intense peace and tranquility. And the drugs lied to me. They said that they would offer me that. They would offer me love, acceptance, peace, serenity. And of course, they offered none of that. Crack, cocaine, cat, and then eventually crystal meth. And crystal meth is the one that I love the most, because it did what my first alcoholic binge did. It switched me off. I found thousands of ways to kill myself. And the drugs switched me off. That's what I wanted. I wanted to just flatline and not feel.
So the thing that, you know, you say you're very high functioning, you were an achiever, you were successful. Would you say that you absorbed everything from the environment through you? You were highly empathetic as well.
Yes, I do feel my way around the world. I am a feeling, emotional person. You don't have to be very emotional to be a feeling person, by the way.
It's a difference.
Yeah, there is a difference. I have a very strong intuition about myself. Now I'm very intuitive without getting very emotional.
Yeah.
And yes, I do feel I have that makeup.
Yes. Sometimes that need to switch off so hard, so like a hard reset, is because your frequencies are all firing together and you take in so much of the environment and people and their crap. And it's an overwhelm that drives you to want to end it or switch it off at all costs because it's just too much.
I remember often just saying, I'm just trying to cope. And I would tell people in my life, I'm just trying to cope. And what I was saying was, shut up, go away, leave me. It's not mine. And I often talk about handing back the shame. And the shame and I do believe addiction is a shame-based disease. And I hand back the shame every day in certain moments because it's shame that never belonged to me in the first place. The fact that I was a little feminine boy, it's nothing to be shameful of, and it wasn't mine. And the bullying wasn't mine to begin with. And I hand back that shame, like I hand back when I say the comment, I just want to cope. I want to hand back all everybody else's shit. I've got enough of my own.
So where to after, you know, crystal meth, then what happened?
So crystal meth was a gift because it brought me to my knees very quickly. I only used crystal meth for a couple of months. And it very quickly took over my life. It is the darkest, most horrific, evil thing that I've ever loved. Huh. And I need to say that because it is something that I absolutely loved. But there's a moment of rock bottom which I needed to reach. And I just want to qualify here, I'm no professional. I need to just say that up front. I don't know what other people are going through. I can only speak about myself. I'm a storyteller. And to all the listeners out there, take what you want, but leave the rest behind. Just because it happened to me doesn't mean it needs to happen to you or vice versa. Seek professional medical help. So my rock bottom was this moment of desperation. And I was so desperate for the pain to leave my body. And it was a spiritual pain. It's something I can't explain. It wasn't as beyond physical pain. Physical pain, I can handle. Emotional pain, I can handle. It was a spiritual pain that of horror that some people describe that when you're on drugs, your aura around you, you don't actually have an aura. You just have a hole in your aura, a black hole. And that was it. And I was sinking into this abyss. And I looked at what was going on around me. And a miracle moment happened where I do call it a miracle moment, a God moment, where I realized this was going to end. And the end wasn't pretty. And I was handed this gift of desperation. I call it a gift of desperation, where I was desperate to do anything and everything in my power to never, ever, ever, ever touch drugs and alcohol again. I was like, I will do anything, like whatever it takes. And that mantra and that desperation moment is one that lives with me to this day and keeps me clean, apart from all the other stuff I've done. But that moment I never ever want to feel that again.
Was this a build up to that feeling? Or did it suddenly, you were taking, you know, whatever drugs you were taking, and suddenly one day, boom, there's this nothing took you over?
I never wanted to stop using. I wanted to control my using. That's what a lot of addicts try and do. Like, I don't want to, I need to stop. It's not good for me, but let me just control my using. Couldn't control my using. And then, of course, with crystal meth, psychosis takes over. You start seeing things that don't exist, that are not there. A rot takes over. So, I didn't really plan to stop.
Yeah.
That moment.
Okay. So then, I mean, your book is about, your journey through the darkness. And the interesting thing is what you took and how you made your life completely different thereafter. And it's just so incredible. So talk about how you got out of that space and, you know, the journey you embarked on to run a marathon, do a triathlon, you know, you did Ironman. Let's go there.
So I am inherently, I find myself really funny and I do enjoy laughing at life. And my book is filled with moments of humor that with a sense of humor, I look at my life I did a few things that were necessary, and that was get help.
Yeah.
The rule is A, tell someone, B, get help. Always tell someone.
Yeah.
And two, get help. I put my hand up for help, and I was guided to a 12-step program that I started, and I just kept going back. And then I followed every single one of their suggestions, and I went back hundreds of times every day for days on end in the first year, and then in the second year, 4 or 5 times a week, in the third year, 2-3 times a week. And that's where I got my daily vitamins. That's where I got my tools to live a successful life, to live a life that is filled with purpose. And this 12-step program worked for me. I'm a fan of abstinence-based programs. Not harm reduction programs. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with harm reduction programs. I know I cannot have a little bit of alcohol or a little bit of drugs. I tried that before. It's a disaster. And in recovery, I've learned that being clean and sober and of sound mind also leads to a bigger heart and a bigger spirituality. And that's what starts developing.
So Gabor Mate says, addiction is the opposite of connection. So, you know, it's reading your book. I mean, you've come from a close-knit family. You had seemingly lots of support at home. Obviously, out of the home, it's a whole different story. Do you think that these programs, like the 12-step program that you did, is the place where you feel not alone? It's okay to have been through what you've been. Do they provide the connection that enables you to walk through the addiction?
Absolutely. You know, they say that we love you until you learn to love yourself in the program. And And I was surrounded by people on that very first night. Those of you who are older, over 40, will remember a program on TV called Cheers. And funny, yes. It's in a bar. And the song in the beginning says, "You want to go where everybody knows your name." Okay. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted that feeling where you walk into a room and everybody knows your name. And yes. And people get you. And there's no judgment. There's no gossip. There's just, yes, support. And it's a self-funding program that is anonymous, that works around the world and is for free. All of it was for free. I did seek further counsel. I did seek a therapist. And with my privilege, I'm lucky enough to be able to pay for that. And then my journey did involve chemically the taking of drugs to assist with depression. Because after my first 9 months clean, you know, I was looking at all these people around me going, "Oh, you know, I'm so clean and I'm so serene." And I was just white knuckling. And I went to go see a psychiatrist, and I had classic depression symptoms. And I was medicated to the point of normality. My meds make me feel normal. And I'm very grateful. I often say I'm very grateful to Glaxo and to Pfizer and to Lilly for the fantastic day that they've given me. It's a day where the way I describe my medication, and for those nervous to go on a journey of medication, yes, we had to tinker with the amounts and the brands and the doses. And yes, I had to push through some like downers after many years of using one tablet that stopped working, trying another psychiatrist. Yes, but it's worth it because then a moment comes in where the meds make me feel normal. I now have a normal reaction to life. People say, "Yeah, they dull your senses or whatever." Absolutely. Well, depends which ones you take. My meds take 4 to 6 weeks to kick in. Okay. So they're hardly a high. But now when somebody dies, I have a normal reaction. I laugh when I'm supposed to laugh. I cry when I'm supposed to cry. I have energy. Psychiatry and psychiatric medication, I have come down on it. I have a fantastic psychiatrist. I love her to bits. Her aim is to get me on as little medication as possible. And now many years later, I'm down to tiny little doses, tiny. Crack these small pills in half and lose that speckle. They're not mind-altering drugs. They are they're brain-enhancing drugs. So that's what I'd like to call them.
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate use of pharmaceuticals. Everyone is so, you know, so polarized. It's bad for you. It's good for you. It's like, hang on a second. If it's used appropriately and it's increasing your quality of life, then it's very much appropriate for you. But it's got to be... I really think, you know, you've got to find the right doctor that you can have an open and very honest conversation with, who's prepared to listen to you and work with you over time because your needs change.
And so, suicidal ideation is life-threatening. It's not something to be taken lightly.
Absolutely. While we're on the subject of suicide, depression and medication, you know, when we look at someone like yourself who's come as far as you have has been through so much trauma, who's been to the dark side and, you know, come out the other side, no one talks about the rebound, the chance of going backward. You know, everyone thinks it's all hunky-dory and everything's going to be fine from here on out, but is it a daily mindfulness practice to keep yourself where you are?
So it's a tank you fill up. So in the beginning of recovery, my tank was in minus, okay? And it's a tank I fill up. And sometimes the tank is full. And if the tank is full, I can go days without meditating. I can go maybe a couple of weeks without really checking in spiritually. Yeah. But then the tank is depleting slowly, 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 slowly. I have a very... And I know, like I often say, I know when I'm like 6 months away from a relapse because my tank is so full. It's so full. But there are some times where I'm about 2-3 weeks away from a relapse and I know what I need to do. And I have, you know, we have pillars in our program, you know, They're very simple. Trust God, clean house, help others. So have some trust in a higher power. Keep your house in order, which also means your mental house, your emotional house in order, and help others. There's nothing more therapeutic than speaking to somebody else and making it about them. It changes the energy cycle of addiction from this self-absorbed obsession into this giving moment of I'm here to serve you. And literally it tricks any addictive thoughts and switches them off. It expels them.
And there's your connection again.
100%.
All right. So let's talk about, you know, were you a runner, you know, going through all of this? What happened that went, I'm going to go start running?
I ran well in primary school, but then smoking got in the way. So I found ways to not do sport from the age of 14. And when I say not do sports, I mean nothing. Like other than dancing on a dance floor or walking to the car or walking in a mall, I'm a city boy. I did zero exercise. And so when I woke up one day, you know, when you're in recovery, all of a sudden, I mean, not only do you suddenly have some money, you also just have all these hours in the day. You're like, geez, the day is long. And like, and then you wake up before your alarm clock and you're staring out the window going, now what? Okay. So there was a thing. It's almost like the body says, okay, I can hear you fixing yourself. You need to fix me too. And I got this like almost calling from my body to say, come, let's just try something. And my partner at the time, he was running. So I put on some dodgy shoes and went for a run. And I describe it in my book. I don't want to give too much away, but how I started running was hysterical, hilarious. I did very little running. I thought I was a champion. I remember when I finished, it got me to my first 21K run about a year and a half later. And when I did my first half marathon, I walked 16 kilometers of it. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I finished just before the end. And when I was looking down the last phase of the run, there was a man in front of me who was affected with dwarfism. Okay. And he had bow legs. He was bow-legged man affected with dwarfism, and he was ahead of me. Okay. It's like that. Like, and I was like, you go, guy. If he can do it, I can do it. But I thought my ego kicked in. I was like, I need to at least beat him. Okay. At least run the last 100 meters, Costa. And I did. And I finished just before the cutoff time. And I wore the medal on the plane on the flight back from Cape Town. I was such, and I thought I'd run like a 200 miler that nobody else had run. And, you know, in that moment, I realized, and because I had no fitness and I've never done anything before, I just always celebrated all my little wins. And any win was a win. Any race finished was a win.
Absolutely.
You know, I have a box of medals. And when I'm really down and I'm just having a good day, I pull out the box of medals and they make this like clinking sound. Clink, yes. Clink, 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 clink. And I just shake them and I bounce them. And the one day I put them all on. And it's just like that, all these shared moments of feeling good about myself. And I never beat myself up. And I not beating myself up is what took me far. I then just thought, you know, this running thing is a lot of stress on just one part of the body. Let me maybe start like triathlon because it's swimming as well and cycling. And I thought, let me just do a tiny little itty bitty triathlon. And then years later, I'd done like 11 half Ironmans, three full Ironmans.
Okay.
Like I took it far. And I took it to a place of success and joy for me. People often say, you just gave up one addiction for another. And I feel like I always need to address that because the definition of addiction is something compulsive, firstly, that makes your life chaotic and unmanageable. So now, let me tell you, I never had the compulsion to jump out of bed at 6 a.m. and go for a run. Okay. And everyone's like, oh, I'm dying to go for a 180 kilometer ride. Okay. That's bull. There's no compulsion in that. And all it did it make my life chaotic and unmanageable? No. It made me regular, reliable, yeah. healthy, present,
yeah.
all of those things. So I'd rather say it was a healthy obsession. Sure, I was rather obsessed with everything around triathlon. Did it damage relationships? No. Did it add to my mental health? Yes.
Yeah.
Clearly not an addiction.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's just step back again a little bit. And, you know, after that first run, when you decided that you didn't want to sleep in your bed alone on a Sunday morning and you decided to try running. And the first run is always a disaster. You think, what the hell? What drove you to keep trying?
So what drove me to keep trying was the incremental gains that I felt. And my mantra, which became... and again, it's in the book. I don't want to give away the funny story around it, but my mantra around aiming low, because I was just like, let me just run a 5K race. In fact, my first 5K race, I was like, let me walk it and see if I can finish before the time. Okay. Now, I mean, at that stage, I'm a 37-year-old, very able-bodied, lean, tall guy who clearly looks like he can run to the front. And I let everybody run away and I started walking. I was like, we've got this. And I was like, okay, maybe I can shuffle. Yeah. So I shuffled a little. I was like, okay, maybe I can trot a little. I was like, no, I can't trot. So I shuffled the whole race. I finished in just under an hour and I rewarded myself with a McDonald's burger. Reward was important for me.
Yeah.
And the reward made me feel so good about myself. So I put my goals very, very low. Ironman was never in my dream. In fact, it came, you know, I mean, when I did finally have an Ironman dream, I gave myself 2 years. I was already fit, but I gave myself 2 years to get there. You know, versus a lot of people, oh, I'll do it in 6 months' time. I was like, no, let's take our time.
No.
And when I did get there, I was like, hey, let's enjoy first. You know, the aim was always enjoyment. It was never to, I beat myself up so for so much of my life. I harmed so much of myself. There is no way I'm going to look at my body and say, come on, Costa, you're slow. You're useless. Move it. You know how a lot of people like talk to themselves to motivate themselves. I talk and I say, you've never gone this far before. So if you stop now, you've done amazingly. So I always gave myself an opportunity to give up. Stop.
Where did you learn to be kind to yourself, to speak kindly to yourself? Because this is a really interesting theme you've mentioned. We do beat ourselves up. We are harsh on ourselves. Somebody once said, I think I heard it on a podcast, if you spoke to your best friend the way you speak to yourself, you wouldn't have any friends. Then you start listening to yourself talk and you go, oh my God, they're right. Where did you learn to be compassionate with yourself?
So my life happens in cycles, and there are times when I'm very compassionate with myself. And there are times when I'm less compassionate with myself. But I've learned to catch myself. And with a clean living life comes a bunch of friends, family, loved ones that, you know, now connect with me emotionally and spiritually. Uh-huh. So you've always got somebody around me. I've always got somebody around me to kind of check me and go, oh, well, like, what's up with your vibe? You all dodge. And I go, oh, actually, I don't feel good about myself. Uh-huh. And then I go, why am I not feeling good about myself? Because I'm speaking negatively to myself. But the one thing I do that works is I journal most mornings. I wake up and I battle to meditate. I battle with mindfulness. Mm. I battle with sitting still. I battle sometimes with prayer, but I never battle with writing. So writing is my mindfulness, my spiritual program, my prayer. And I sit down and sometimes I just dump on the page. I go, I hate myself. I hate life. This is shocking. Sis on me. I could have done better. Blah, 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 blah. And then after 10 lines of that, I go like, okay, am I finished now? Okay. All right, like, are you done? When I write how much I hate myself down, I stop it. So it's a fantastic tool, writing. And they've proven it that you can't consistently write a lie in your own handwriting. Did you know that?
True, yes.
And my body then goes, like, stops writing. It goes like, okay, like, I'd rather not write than write this rubbish that you hate yourself, because we know that's not true. And thoughts, for me, thoughts and feelings are often not fact. They're just thoughts. They're just feelings. Sit back, dodge them. Let them just pass me. So meditation, when I do meditate, is what helps me observe the thoughts and let them go. For now in my life, I'm using writing to just let things go and be.
When did you start writing? Did you journaling? Was that the start of you writing your book? How did that happen? Because that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that is a whole other story. Funny enough, before I started Hard Drugs, I did a course called The Artist's Way. And journaling is like a prerequisite of doing the course. And that's when I actually started writing, just dumping. And in fact, that's when all my issues came up and I was looking at them on a page. And, you know, that's when I got really scared about where I was at in life. But I started writing then. And then, of course, with an active addiction, I stopped writing. In recovery, there's writing every day. There's a whole lot of exercises I needed to do every day, every week, every month with a sponsor. I worked the program. I wrote a lot. I read it all out to him. And then that morning writing just took over. And I just thought to myself one day, I was actually on holiday and I was like, I'd like to become a speaker. You know, I've got a message. I want to give meaning to all of this stuff that I've done. And so it actually happened by accident. I was like, speaking, I know I can do, but most speakers today have a book. I was like, well, then let me write a book and see if I've got something to say.
Love it.
So yeah. I sat down and started writing and couldn't stop writing.
Yeah.
because like, I was like, I clearly have something to say. I love what I'm saying and I just couldn't stop writing. So it actually, speaking is my primary goal. But I did the book first.
Yes. And they feed off each other.
Yeah. Do you know, it's so funny. People think you're clever because you've got a book. Like, people think you can speak because you've got a book. They're like, oh, he's got a book, then he can speak. I'm like, well, I could say all of this before I wrote the book, but yes, thank you for that. I call it a very heavy business card. I first wanted a ghostwriter. Maybe I'll do it myself. And I'm so glad when I read my book, a lot of my friends say it sounds like speaking to me. It's a very conversational book. And that's how I speak.
Very important that it's your voice. Otherwise, it wouldn't have the impact that it does. Yeah. So where to from here? I mean, you're an Ironman, you're a marathon runner. What is next for you? I mean, you're on TV, you're on, you know, where's your life, exciting life going now?
I stopped running. That's where I need to tell you why. Because I wasn't addicted, and I wanted some other things in life.
Uh-huh.
So I thought to myself, I want, you know, when you're a triathlete and a runner, you just land up with this very super skinny body, and I had a little belly. You know, I was like, no, I actually want some shoulders for a change. Mm-hmm. You know, I want some shoulders, I want some biceps, and I changed careers. I opened a few restaurants, and I got going with that, and I just wanted more of a gym body and a gym. And I also wanted some strength. I had endurance, but I could feel I didn't have strength.
Sure.
So I started that, and I've got a hell of a lot of strength now. So going back to running is something that I dabble in now and again. And when I do run, these legs have got some new power. The lungs don't keep up just yet, but that'll take time. But the legs are now I've got strength. So I've got unfinished business in PE at full Ironman, because my third Ironman didn't go well because I had an injury. And I want to go back and just do some more. So I definitely want to continue. It is in the pipeline. Mm. I currently have a neck injury, which is from whiplash from many years ago, but I'm working through that. Where to from here? Well, my speaking career is something that I am now applying most of my attention to. I really love and enjoy it. And what I started, because I'm crazy enough to believe I can do it, is I started stand-up comedy. And
brilliant.
I started it very, very lightly a few years ago, doing like once every couple of months. COVID hit. And then I started taking it a little bit more seriously. And just last month, I did the Hilton Arts Festival.
Wow.
I put on six shows. I got paid.
Paid to be so funny. I love
now
it.
I'm legit funny. I'm a legit funny guy. So my comedy is something that I absolutely love. I don't laugh at myself. I bring light to what has shaped me. I laugh at bullying and how I've healed. Because I have healed to a degree very healthily, I can laugh at it.
Yes.
I laugh at being shamed to make a point. And because, you know, humor is very, very closely linked to tragedy. And my talk and my voice when I speak, I'm a humorist. I like calling myself a humorist as a speaker. I make light of things that just break the tension, the taboo, the stigma in the room, because we need to talk about these things. And if I'm strong enough to talk about hectic things and make you laugh with me, not at me, there's a big difference. You know, when you haven't healed, people are laughing at you.
Yeah.
And that's just jest, and there you are just the clown. But you're laughing with me because I've cried through it and now I'm laughing with it, and I'm inviting you to laugh with me at my big fat crazy Greek life.
Brilliant.
So yeah, comedy is definitely happening. My television acting comes and goes. I'm opportunistic. I did a telenovela last year. I did 5 episodes, which was absolutely amazing. I loved it. I want variety. I want experience. That's what I've asked of this lifetime, and learning and healing. And I'm given all these opportunities. And now speaking is the one that, it's something that comes natural to me. I want to get on stage. I want to inspire and entertain and make people laugh. And I get off the stage feeling full. I don't get a lot from other people. I fill myself up. And I always leave feeling fuller than when I got on the stage. It's a lovely, lovely feeling.
So in closing, we've got a really wide audience listening to the show, and no doubt many, many people listening will have gone through their own traumas and their own sense of feeling hopeless and helpless. What's your message to anyone listening? What is the first step you would advise somebody to take if they're feeling like they're sitting on that floor, on the bottom of the barrel?
Whatever makes you feel down and at the bottom of whatever barrel, whether it's your eating, whether it's your spending, your gambling, your ex, boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, your kids, whatever, it's important to tell someone.
Yeah.
I always say, and I'm speaking particularly to men, and particularly to children, tell someone.
Mm.
Tell someone when you mate, I thought about killing myself yesterday. Tell someone.
Yeah.
When you're a child, a teacher did something that I wasn't comfortable with. Tell someone. And we all have that one person in our life, no matter how lonely we think we are. It could be a shop assistant. It could be the librarian at school. It could be that one person who at work, is like always like just a little bit extra kind.
Yeah.
Just tell someone, be brave enough to tell someone, because that's where the miracle of healing starts. That's where you open yourself up. It's a tiny little step you take. And if that someone doesn't help or isn't of assistance, tell somebody else. But it's the start of a process, and then let your process unfold. And I told someone, and then I told as many people as possible, and then I did everything they told me to do. And if you want to change, here's another thing. If you want to change, there's, and again, most of the cliches I've been saying today are not my own. I've heard them somewhere else, and this one I've heard in the program. If you want to change, you only have to change one thing, and that's everything.
Yeah.
And like another thing I say is like, how free do you want to be? And I want to remain free.
Yes.
I feel free now. So by a miracle of my higher power, this is not my own work.
Yeah.
I rocked up. I rocked up for my recovery and my higher power did the rest.
Yes.
I can't explain 16 years and 6 months and 2 days clean.
Yeah.
And I do count them.
Yeah.
I do count
them. It's important.
Because they're important to me. Yeah, they're important to me, and I count them to give thanks.
Yes.
It's an act of gratitude for me. So yes. I would say tell someone, secondly, do what they say.
Yeah.
Because if you want to be free, we've got to take the steps. And this, we get fed so much rubbish these days that life is something that, you know, happens freely and happily. There's ebbs and flows, ups and downs, and just like my depression left me 2 years ago, it came back a year later for a few weeks, and then it left me again.
Yeah.
And let's get into the rhythm of life, into the cycles, that's when the beauty of life comes up, and the moments are magical.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely magical.
You don't know happiness till you touch the unhappiness.
100%. Oh, I love that. I'm stealing that cliche.
With pleasure.
Great.
So, Costa, thank you so much for blessing us with your story, because I know for a fact that it's going to help so many other people overcome their traumas and what they're dealing with. So, yes, we've got to tell someone and we've got to get our stories out there, because it heals. There's a ripple effect to this. So thank you so much for your vulnerability and your ability to communicate what is happening in your heart and through your life. It's massively valuable.
Thank you, Nikki. And thank you for enjoying my book. I can't wait for you to finish it and hear some more from you.
Yes.
Well done on this really amazing platform that you've created out of like something you love. I'm so impressed. And to all the listeners out there, let's keep supporting Nikki, because she's doing fantastic work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you once again for joining me for another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. As usual, all of my guests' details can be found in the show notes page on Apple Podcast, Anchor, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Please don't forget to rate on Apple and leave a review.